Welcome to the final episode of the Building Better Leaders podcast for 2020. Born out of the pandemic, John and I first came up with the idea for this podcast as a way to connect with our clients and leaders in the wider community at a time when we were unable to meet face to face. We set ourselves a goal of doing one podcast a week, and I'm pleased to say we've made it. There are now 22 episodes and we've had over 1,000 listens. So I'd just like to say a massive thank you to everybody who has supported, promoted and listened to this podcast. But before we say goodbye to 2020, we have two great things to share with you. First up is our coaching competition. We're giving away free coaching sessions in January for 5 lucky winners. The details of how to enter, just go to scaffoldcoaching.com. The second thing is today's podcast guest, Jan Iserton. Jan is the chair of SmartWorks Manchester. SmartWorks is a charity that dresses and coaches unemployed women for job success. It's a charity that is also super well known for its 2019 launch of the Smart Set Capsule Collection, which was a collaboration with the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, in partnership with brands such as John Lewis, M&S, Jigsaw and Michelin. This year has seen unemployment rise and the SmartWorks Christmas campaign is giving the gift of confidence. So we've asked Jan to join us for a conversation to talk to us about her incredible transformational leadership career. Starting her career at Fujitsu on the management trainee programme to launching a FTSE 50 company in the USA with a team of just 4 people. To juggling motherhood, knowing when to bail out of business, and finding your purpose after retirement. This conversation with Jan spans over 30 years of her career. It's full of golden nuggets for anyone in leadership, sales, and women in particular looking to build their confidence next year and beyond. We finished the conversation talking about SmartWorks and the challenges they've had this year. If you enjoy this conversation and would like to help, please do donate on the link in the show notes or on smartworks.org.uk. Jan has certainly given me a lot to think about and I hope she does the same for you too. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to our Building Better Leaders podcast. This is episode number 22. This is the last one of 2020. So I'm delighted to introduce Jan. Jan has had such a wonderful varied career. She's now chair of SmartWorks in Greater Manchester. She's had various leadership positions, everything from FTSE 500 and global corporations to tech startups, and working for corporate boards and investors and running her own consultancy business. So, Jan, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Yeah, hi, and thank you very much for the opportunity to meet your listeners, albeit through podcasts. It's fantastic. I feel like I've been working forever. And then when opportunities like this present themselves to look back at your career, you realise you actually have been working forever. I was very fortunate. I came from one of those poor, forgotten towns in the northeast of England and managed to scrap my way to Manchester Met University. And I did a business degree. And that's when I decided Manchester would become my home, and I've stayed here, apart from when I lived in the States for a little period. I've stayed here my whole life, and I think we live in a wonderful community, a very generous, supportive city that allows for people like me to have amazing careers. So I started, like I think you do when you do a business degree, back in those days, I'm talking like the 80s, you were often encouraged to go to the biggest corporate you could get to and go on their grad scheme. And then they put you in different departments and they worked out what your specialism could be. And they were great schemes, but there are very few of those around at the moment. And they haven't been for maybe 5-10 years. So I went to work for a company called Fujitsu, which was global IT tech company. I'm not the most tech savvy person in the world. So I managed to find myself into a business development role, which I shouldn't say really, because I think nowadays people who are selling tech understand tech a lot better than I did back in the day. But it was fantastic, loads of training, loads of development. I was actually surprised, to be honest, that there wasn't too much of a glass ceiling in that organisation. I honestly thought there would be, and I was prepared for it. But I don't know whether I was one of those lucky people that got singled out early on, that we are going to now actively promote women in the organisation, and I kind of rode on the coattails of that. And then from that period, I then went into this new industry that was emerging, called business process outsourcing, where you take on another organization's function and you deliver them more effectively and more efficiently, higher quality, quicker, faster, and all that. And I absolutely love that. And that's probably when my identity as a leader really started to form in my own mind. I'd been in leadership positions before, but it had been maintaining the company stuff, so it was more of a management role. But then in the outsourcing organization, it was a brand new company spawned out of United Utilities, FTSE 50 company, and we were like this little startup organization within that. And it was basically a bit of a free-for-all, as in if you wanted to be a leader of a function, you made your pitch, you said why you demonstrated the necessary credentials of leadership, and you were able to fly with it, really. And myself and a lot of people who work for that organisation called Vertex will say it was probably the best 10 years of our careers. And then with them, I went to North America, and I set up part of the outsourcing business in North America, which was crazy days, which I'm sure you'll ask me some questions about. And then after I'd finished with all of my working for other people, part of my career, I decided to set up my own organisation, and I was very fortunate enough to work for some of the venture capitalists in London and in Manchester. When they went in to acquire organisations, they had all the very clever analysts that would say what the company was worth, what the market was worth, etc., etc., and then they'd ask someone like me to come in and say, yeah, but can these people sell? Can they actually sell? And that's what I used to do, due diligence, and then quite often if the VC then bought the company, they'd ask me to go in for a year and run the sales and marketing functions for the organisation. So, yeah, and that was almost it until I joined a company I'd worked with as a consultant for a time, and I'd mentored the young chief executive for some period. And they asked me to join that organisation with the specific reason of selling it for as much money as possible within a time frame, and that's what we did. So I ended up retiring in 2017 and found my way to SmartWorks.
Wonderful. Wow. Absolutely wonderful. You right at the beginning there, when you were leaving university then, Jan, I mean, it was a different world then for all of us. What advice would you give now to somebody that's leaving university? Because a lot of those schemes aren't really running anymore. And they were a platform to get people up and running, weren't they, quite quickly. What advice would you give to somebody that's leaving now?
Well, I think it might be a little bit late now specifically regarding lockdown, but I think volunteering is an amazing way for young people to join organisations and demonstrate their skills, demonstrate their commitment to wider things going on in our society. So I think volunteering alongside a job search is quite an important thing to do if it's accessible to you. I think that there aren't as many of those big corporate grad schemes around, but there are startups everywhere, and you will earn a little less, but you'll learn a lot more very, very quickly, and you'll be given more responsibility than you ever imagined you could cope with at the age of, 21 or something. So I think those organisations, whilst they're not going to make you rich, they are going to give you a lot of experience very, very quickly. So there are, I would look small as well as big corporate. And we've got some fantastic organisations on our doorstep. We've got a lot of the business process companies around, like Teleperformance. We've got massive organisation in the Hut Group who've just said they're recruiting 300 plus people. There are organisations that are recruiting and have actually grown through this period of lockdown. So think about which organisations might be really flourishing because we've moved our retail purchases online, tech organisations. There's a new vaccine coming out, hopefully. So organisations that are involved in data analysis regarding health, you know, there will be lots of fresh opportunities come out of the back of that. So I think it's important to think about that, demonstrate your thought processes around why those industries might be of use to you. If you've got a volunteering opportunity comes your way, take it, and then try and stay confident, because we will come through this. And Manchester historically has offered graduates great employment opportunities, and we will bounce back. I'm a firm believer in the employee GM objectives and build back better that's going on at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. I think what you kind of glossed over, but how you said you'd come from the Northeast and moved to Manchester. And I think something that perhaps young people forget now is they've all got a much clearer idea of what they want to do. Whereas I think in the 80s, 90s, and even in the 2000s was you just kind of went and tried something, then you worked out what you wanted to do. And I think that's the role that the grad scheme kind of had, was you wanted the aim was to get on a grad scheme. It wasn't to decide what you wanted to do. Whereas today, perhaps people come with the mindset of they know what they want to do, then they get disappointed when they don't get it. And actually maybe just changing your kind of thing to just go in and trying something might be, if we just had a little bit of that hunger back, that might work.
I think that's good advice, Rachel, because as a 21-year-old, I had no clue whether I wanted to go into HR. I didn't know I wanted to go into business development, selling, as it used to be called in old money. And I was great at it. I was absolutely great at it. Was confident, was creative, loved the buzz of the environment. And the reason why I went into it off the grad scheme was I got a company car.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, actually. It sounds like Fujitsu was such an incredible, you mentioned that they seemed really ahead of the time in really how they promoted women and really tried to give women a leg up, if you like. But what was it that drew you to sales, particularly, except for the car?
Well, I was never going to excel in the tech side of the business, because there were people who'd done computer science degrees, engineering degrees, who were frankly smarter than me. They actually understood the fundamentals of how everything worked, and I didn't. What I liked about it was tech could solve business problems. So I dealt a lot with local authorities, and they were dealing with huge benefit claims or council tax kind of claims, and they had paper everywhere. So the company developed a technology to digitize all the paper and put it straight. You could then use a workflow system to push it to somebody's desktop. So for me, that was the in. It was like, right, I can understand that business's problems, and I can understand enough of the tech to know that we can make 40% efficiency gains, 25% speed to process. So I could understand the application of the technology and how to vision that for the clients, and very much leadership and business development leadership is a lot about creating a vision for others to then follow. So that's when I first started to understand that I could be successful in a tech company, but I also started to understand a little bit of that inspirational piece that you absolutely need if you're going to be a leader, certainly a leader in a transformative type of industry.
Amazing. And how old were you when you kind of first realised that leadership might be something that you would pursue?
Yeah, well, I was a manager of a sales function across the whole of the UK for Fujitsu. But then a friend of mine came and said, oh, we'll have been here for 10 years, Jan, this year. We can look in the company, the employee catalogue, and pick a gift. And I said, well, I don't want a carriage clock or a garden shed. So I realised that I had to leave. And then I actually sat back and I thought, you know what, I've learned a lot. That company has invested a lot of money in me and added all sorts of training every year on the grad scheme. They really looked after you. They didn't want their investment to walk out the door. And I think I did 10 years, so I did probably pay them back for all that support.
Yeah.
And then when I went to the startup within United Utilities, I realised, then I went there and they'd pulled together a senior leadership team who I just felt, I observed them for a few weeks and I thought, you know what, I'm at least as good as you, if not twice as good as you. So this is where I will start making my pitch to be the business development director. And I started with that in mind. So I acted as if, that leadership technique, that if you want a role, act as if you've already got it and you're probably 9/10 of the way there. And I planned my campaign to what I wanted to achieve at the end of the first year, what I wanted to achieve at the end of the second and third year. And because the business was new, it was a new industry, was fresh thinking, but we had the security of United Utilities financial position behind us. It was just a really dynamic, fresh organisation that allowed someone like me, still relatively young, female, Northern accent, to smash through it all, really, and go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds like you had so much confidence. Were you a confident kid? Where did that confidence come from?
Well, I'm the middle child of three daughters, and one of us had to go to university. My dad decided it was me. It was literally not more thought through than that, to be honest. And I guess I was confident. I'm not always at the front with my hand up first asking a question. I am quite a thinker and a listener as well. But I never liked to see a job not done well. And if I thought I could do the job better than the person that was doing it, particularly if it was somebody managing me, then it was quite easy for me to say, you know what, the problem isn't that person, the problem's me, because I should be doing that job. And I had enough confidence in my own abilities to see where I could actually deliver better than somebody else who was meant to be doing it. Mm. And I built good teams. I always believe that, you know, I hate that old, there's no I in team, but I really believe it. And leadership is sometimes about followership, and it's about not always being at the front. It's about building a team of people who give you positive energy. They don't always have to be the more skillful, but they have to be motivated and believe in where you're going on your journey. So building good teams that gave me a lot of confidence as well.
At this point then in your career, Jan, you were just about to go to the States. What drove you to go there? Was it just that there was a job opportunity there, a role opportunity? And how different did you find working there than working here in the UK?
Yeah, well, there wasn't a job opportunity, but me and the guy I worked for at the time on the main board of Vertex, we made the opportunity happen because we believed that our proposition was so strong that we had a limited market in the UK because of the types of company we were selling into the energy and utilities marketplace. And deregulation had happened in the UK, so we had a lot of market knowledge ahead of other markets deregulating over in North America, and we could have applied that knowledge and skills and experience of delivering in that business environment to those organisations. So we knew that we had a story, and again, a lot of leadership is about a story and a metaphor. We knew we had a story that we could wrap a proposition around, and we could sell it to dozens more organisations over there, and it was also English speaking, which made it a lot easier. So, and United Utilities had a presence already in North America. So it wasn't a market that was scary to what is actually a low risk, highly regulated organization. So we kind of made the job, John and myself made the job up, and we pitched it to the company, and they said, yes, you can go, but it's going to be on a really low cost. So when I took a team of, I think there were four of us, we went out to Washington DC, and we'd already struck up a partnership with a very large tech organization. We worked with Capgemini and IBM, so we'd already created a strategic partnership with them, so we knew that we could use their offices. So when we went to do our business development activities, we would fly to wherever the IBMers or the Cap guys were working, and so we didn't have the expense of offices and things like that. But it was very bizarre, strange, mad, crazy, fantastic time of my career. And everybody who went there absolutely loved it. Quite a few of them stayed and still live and work in Vertex outsourcing over in North America. But it was just a fantastic time. And to think that an organisation like UU would have the confidence in someone like myself to go out there. But they had no risk, you see. I mean, if I had failed, they would have fired me and I'd have had to come back home with my tail between my legs. But you know what? That's another leadership thing, isn't it? Right there, you can't be afraid of flying.
No, and you can't. You have to take risks.
Yeah, feel the fear and do it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very important.
So what you had in there was that really having a story for leadership, getting a proposition that you can wrap it around. What you spoke about before was really understanding the customer's problem, and then not being afraid to fail, I guess. And, yeah. And is there anything you want to add for that, for being, what made you such a great salesperson?
Well, I was always very good at qualifying, by which I mean there's lots of qualification techniques that business developers can use that you're trained in. And it's normally around the money, the emotion, authority, needs, timescales and things like that. And the idea being is that you constantly see how you are faring compared to your competitor in that specific individual pursuit of a sales opportunity. So because I did really big deals, I wasn't selling mass market products. My solutions were $100 million, you know, 10-year big outsourcing deals. You could only probably run with three of those in a year because of the size of your team and the expense, and it would take maybe 9 months. So if you were wrong in your qualification, you could end up doing nothing and wasting a lot of the company's time and money. And that opportunity isn't going to come around again for probably another 7 or 8 years. So I was very ruthlessly hard on qualifying, and I would walk away from something that I knew in my heart we weren't going to win. I would walk away quicker than anybody else because I didn't, I wasn't there to waste my very talented team's energy and skills on stuff we weren't going to win. And the decision about whether we were going to win it or not was mine. You know, I was the leader. I had to say, yes, if we do this, and this, we can win it. Or, you know what, doesn't matter what we do, we're not going to win it. They're in the lead. We haven't got a better proposition. They'll just erode the price point. We're not going to win it. And it was hard, very hard at times, particularly remotely, on a dodgy old dial-up conference call line from hotels in the middle of the night, so that it was 11 o'clock in Manchester, you know, to say that you'd been pursuing something for 4 months and it was worth £100 million, but guess what, I'm qualifying out. It's pretty tough to do that. It's easier to carry on and lose it at the end than to say really early on, no, this one's not for us.
You have to pick your fights, but it's very brave to have to leave something when you have invested time in it. But I guess when the stakes are that high and the value and the contracts are so high, you just can't hang around, can you?
You just can't. And if you know in your heart as a business developer and the leader of a team, if you know in your heart that the competition, you can't outwit them, you can't outrun them, they've got a better proposition at a better price, you've just got to stop wasting your time and move on to the next one where you might fit a lot better. But it is hard to do that. A less brave person would carry on because, you know, that, what is it people say? You don't get fired if you're really busy. But I just couldn't waste my team's talent on stuff that wasn't going to come to fruition. So,
When you talked about the team, though, as well, because I've worked a lot in these kind of environments where you might go to pitch against 10, 6, 7, it doesn't matter how many other organisations, and you're like, but we've got to go to that level. And actually, as a team member, some people would prefer that, but some people would prefer the honesty and the ruthlessness of, no, we're only going if it's 2 against 2 and we're going to go 100%, but we're only going to go for 1 or 2. So you talked about how you used this to lead great teams, but did you find you attracted a certain team member by having that mindset?
Well, I'm sure they would probably say, yeah, if you were tough and if you weren't hardworking and you weren't positive, then you wouldn't make it on Jan's team. But I had to also have the full breadth of skills, because when you're building an outsourcing solution, you need somebody who's deeply tech, someone who's a resource planner, someone who can model your costs and your profits, someone who can do a legal contract. You know, you needed about 6 disciplines. In the States they call them swim lanes, but you needed about 6 disciplines, and then you needed people who knew the content, billing, call center, MISA reading. So you managed a multidisciplined team, and they can't be all your type of person. So you've got to, as a leader, you've got to embrace somebody deeply tech who won't be rushed, who needs to go through the process that he needs to go through to come to his conclusion, and a lawyer who will want to mark up a client's document so it's red pen everywhere. And I used to find that incredibly rude to a client. So I'd be constantly negotiating with the lawyer to step back from all the markup, do a light touch, da da da. So I don't know, really. I think people who join me because they got the inspired vision. They got the vision of what we were trying to do. And I think they must have believed that I had the right skills to keep them motivated on the journey to achieving that vision. And that's possibly why they believed in me.
Yeah, give us an example of some of the things you would do to motivate them on that vision.
Well, I made sure we had a lot of fun, because when you're working away from home, you know, we'd moved to the States, most of us, we used to fly people in from the UK quite a lot. And we'd work from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. And we'd then go to the bar and the team would carry on modelling solutions in the bar to try and get to the right price point that we wanted to put in front of the client. So we worked long, long hours. So I made sure that along with those long, long hours, we also had some fun. So we put the laptops away. I'd take them out for a nice meal. They'd go off wandering and get up to all sorts because they were a bit younger than me. So I motivated them in terms of the energy that we took to what we were doing. I tried to watch them to make sure that if there were little fallouts. I remember one time I had a fantastic solution designer and a tech guy, and they couldn't stand each other. And I had to talk to them both separately and say, I can't have this. You know, we're a team of eight. And if two out of eight don't get on, that's a big problem. So try and find some common ground and get together and talk about it. But you've got to fix it, because I haven't got energy and time to waste on this type of stuff. So I'd pick, if I saw that things were starting to get frayed, mainly because we were working so hard and away from home for a long time, I did used to step in and try and counsel them through it a little bit. And then I was always really clear about what I wanted from them and what the timescales were. I need a price that looks like this, that fits, we call it an envelope. This price needs to get into that envelope and I need it by the 30th of the month. So work back from that and tell me what you need for me to do to get more resources to fly in, to give you more tech support. What do you need me to do to get you to the point where the right price is in the envelope by that date? And really listen to them, really support them, because I couldn't do what they did and they knew it. I had none of the skills that they had to build the solutions, to cost it, to really be, I was very good on the contracting side of things, but I'm not a lawyer. So I couldn't be successful without them. So they were really motivating them and keeping them fed, alcoholed up to the extent that they needed to be. I shouldn't say that, should I? And they were happy. And then if they needed to fly home because you could tell the energy had just gone, I'd make arrangements for them to fly home and I'd fly somebody else in to try. And I always had like a B team that I knew I could, not B team from capability, but as in a standing team, that I knew if someone was getting fried, I used to speak to the UK and just say, look, she needs to fly home in a couple of weeks because she's, and stay at home for 2 months because she's just about had it. So, because not everybody wanted to keep my pace up.
Yeah, so really managing and being aware of that need for rest and energy levels. Yeah. And incredible. I mean, you can feel the energy talking to you, like what it would have been like to hard and fast, I can imagine. But what a leadership trait to know that you can't do it by yourself and you don't have their skills, but you do have the vision.
Yes. Yeah, I couldn't do any of that. I couldn't do any of their jobs. And they knew it. And they never once were, all right, if you want that number by then, if you think it's that easy, you come and do it. I never got any pushback like that, because they all knew exactly what they were doing. And they knew that I thought they were the best. The other thing I did was I used to quite often, I'm not sure how I used to get away with it sometimes, I used to say to my boss, who was on the board back in the UK, I'd say, I'm coming home for a week. And you know, I'll find out if I find out anybody else is paid more than my solution executive, I'm going to go mad. So fix it for me before I land. And because I needed to make, we were out on a limb and we didn't know what the grade ranking was in the UK, what was happening with pay rises. And you know what organisations are like when you've been in them for a long time. They sometimes fly, you know, get people in from the outside, pay them 10, 15 grand more because they've got such a great CV. But then in our environment, they're not necessarily successful. So you can get your own team all bent out of shape because they've found out that some superhero with his underpants over his trousers has flown in and has got paid a premium. So I used to always make sure when I went back to the UK that every member of my team was at least exactly where I felt they should be on their professional pay grade and their professional skills development, so that they never felt in the US, well, I've worked for Jam for 2 years, but I haven't done my next exam in my commercial career. I haven't progressed in the solutions team in the UK. I'm still an exec when I should have been a leader or whatever. So I used to always take real care that they knew that they were ranking as well as they should have been had they been in the mothership, as we used to call it.
Wonderful leadership traits, those, Jan. Sounds like there were very few undiscussables. You know, if it needed to be aired, you aired it. And I think one of the things I picked up on there, which I'm really keen on, is the fact that you were saying, look, what to your team, what do you need from me? And I think when they're consulted, they feel part of the team. They feel like they sat alongside you rather than in front of you, if you like. So they're really wonderful leadership traits. And who wouldn't want to work for somebody when that's, you know, you're selling process outsourcing, but you've got a process to lead that team as well. So I think, you know, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it was like a family, really. We, you know, and being away from the corporate body in the UK, it did allow you to become a little bit more like a family. The environment was, you would think it might be straining, but it actually wasn't. It was quite supportive that it was, you know, we felt like a team that had been sent off to a foreign planet and were superstars, and we had to deliver the goods, or else we'd have gone back to the UK with our tail between our legs.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it sounds like you had an amazingly successful career. How do you go from that to starting your own thing? What were the motivations? What were the drivers? What got you thinking, this is something I want to do by myself?
Yeah, so what's really interesting, because I had such an amazing time at Vertex, and anybody who you meet at my age would say the same. It was, you know, sometimes you have the opportunity to be in a business and it's, you can tell it's the golden years. And it was, everybody rose through the ranks. We grew the business phenomenally. It was massively successful while it lasted. And I just didn't think I could get that in another company. I just thought, why am I trying to find something that I knew in my heart was a one-off? And I just thought, no, you know what? I've learned loads, and I'd rather go smaller. I'd rather demonstrate my skills more effectively, more quickly in smaller organisations, you know, have a bigger impact far quicker. And I also had, when I returned from Vertex in the US, I went to work in financial services in Vertex in Cheltenham, brand new market, didn't have a clue what the industry was all about, but managed to get myself through that. And I got divorced, and my daughter was living in Manchester, as was I. That was my home. I was working in Cheltenham. I'd already travelled in the States an awful lot. And I just thought, you know what, I can't do it to my, what was she then, 7-year-old daughter. I need to be at home. And I thought, I need to try and get out of this organisation. And I got made redundant. They had a redundancy programme going on. And my boss at the time, he said, what do you want to happen? And I said, well, I want to go. I want to be got rid of, but I want to go with as big a cheque as possible. So I've been there for over 10 years. It delivered a lot of value. So he managed the situation for me. And it was a funny time in my career, because when there were the new company that had bought Vertex were trying to pull leadership teams together, and I had to really keep my head under the radar, or else I'd have been spotted and they'd have asked me to run another big chunk of the business. And I didn't want to. I knew I needed this time. The only decision I could make would be to get back home, look after my daughter, and start afresh, really. Yeah. So I had maybe a 6-month buffer of money to think differently about what I wanted to do, and I knew I wanted to start up my own organization. And yeah, and I was very fortunate. I met two different individuals who had different types of companies. One did creative presentations to massive big developers, you know, like they've been working on bids for 12 months, and it's to rebuild a housing estate, to rebuild an airport, and the bids are worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds. And then they get told by the client, you've got a week to pull a presentation together. So I would go in and do that. Right, okay, this is what we're going to do. this is your proposition. So there's a lot of pre-reading, a lot of creative work, and then the delivery of it, training the client's team to be ready for the delivery. So I did that, but then I also got taken on by a couple of the venture capitalists to just come in and say, look, I'm buying this company. These are the sales and marketing people. Do you think they're going to be successful? I know the proposition will be successful, but can those individuals make the leap from where they are now to where we need them to be? Because no VC buys a company for it to stay the same size. They buy a company so they can grow the bejesus out of it as fast as possible and take the cash out. So I started doing that, and that was great. So it was day rate stuff. I never employed anybody else in my company, just me. I think my dad might have been company secretary. but it was just me, and I absolutely loved it. And I realized then that I actually preferred leadership in a very small business. I'd done all the big stuff. I'd gone from you couldn't get bigger than Fujitsu, then United Utilities, Vertex. And they were huge organizations. I actually felt my leadership style worked better in smaller organizations. And there's nothing more challenging than when a VC buys a company, they parachute you in as the interim sales and marketing director on day one, and you join a management team who've just sold their company, who think they're it. And you go in to say to them, that's fantastic, but this is what we're gonna do. It's pretty tough, and you've got to have your leadership skills almost nailed onto your shirt the minute you walk in the door, because you've only got maybe two or three meetings to command that position, to really say, I am the new director of this function, and this is why, and this is what we're going to do. You know, you've got to be fast into demonstrating those credentials and delivering the goods, really. So, and I love that. That was just great for me.
Yeah, so you did that for about 8 years.
Probably was about that long. Maybe it might be a little bit less. And then all through that period, I had one client called Utility Group who didn't need a lot of help. They were a great team of smart, smart people in the energy business in Chorley. And I'd mentored the young chief executive there for a while. So when he was trying to set up his own company, he was trying to buy it out, and he thought he was going to get fired at any moment in time. And I used to counsel him and coach him and say, look, if you get fired, you go and walk into a massive big job in Accenture, you're an industry expert, you'll get paid piles of money, don't worry about it. So he asked me to join his company when they were packaging it up to sell it. They had grown it quite exponentially. There was a new thing on the market, as you all know, called smart metering.
Yeah.
And the company developed fantastic software to sell to their clients to enable them to process smart metering data alongside the existing old metering data. And that's what I did. I went to look after quite a different role for me. It wasn't new business, which I'd always done. It was account management. And their top 10 clients were responsible for about 90% of the margin. And they had various different contract endpoints. So for us to be able to get the maximum value for that organization, we had to extend all these 10 contracts. We also had to sign them all up for the new world of smart metering. So that was a 2-year plan with a very, very, very specific objective in mind. Yeah.
But all the while you had your why, which was to look after your daughter as well. So did you manage to keep that balance quite nice during that period?
Yeah, thank you for reminding me about that. That's where this bit started. Yeah, I did. And I'm being honest, I did it just in the nick of time. I needed to be in Manchester. I needed to pick her up from school. I needed to feed her a tea. And yeah. I needed to not be working as much, say, at the weekend when, I just need to read a few emails. I needed to really pull back from a lot of it. So going freelance gave me the opportunity to manage the work. And if I did have big deadlines and big pieces of work to do, I could just do it after she'd gone to bed. You know, my commitment to work didn't need to be as visible to her as it had been previously by me not being there.
And I think that's a big thing that a lot of women struggle with. You know, I'm probably in that period now where you've spent your entire 20s working 12 hours a day, not because you needed to, but because you loved it. And you know, when you were talking then about, I loved nothing more than working all day, then going to the pub after, and we chatted about work. Yeah. That like 3 or 4 times, you know, a week. And then you might have a couple of weeks where you just did your 9 to 5 and you'd cruise, but then you knew you could feel it, couldn't you? You could feel this ramping up of energy.
Yeah.
And then you'd have a month maybe where you were working 12, 14 hours a day. And it can never last, but it becomes this up and down. Yeah. And then a lot of women have children. And that is a very, very difficult mindset shift. It's a very difficult thing to manage with an organization and a boss, because your boss is used to you being available whenever and the leader of the energy. And then there's also this thing of guilt about your child, feel like you're missing out from work. But also I grapple with the mummy guilt thing because I don't really have it, but the commitment to knowing your why and what's important to you, you have to be absolutely locked onto, because everybody will pull you in every direction otherwise.
Yeah.
What are your what are your views on that? How do you manage that? How do you stay so connected to it that you were able to do that for her team? Really?
So I was fortunate in that I had my daughter in my I think I was 34 when I had my daughter, and I'd established a lot of a body of a career before then. I'd had leadership positions and had all the credentials to be able to demonstrate to organisations my value. And I was always really good at codifying my value and articulating it and communicating it. I was always pretty good at that, because I mean, that's the core of selling, right? You know what you've got, know how great it is, know what it can do for your client, and tell them about it. So I could do that in my own skill set and with the audiences I needed to speak to. But I had to learn to say no authentically, say no not necessarily always given a reason, just being able to set boundaries. And I didn't do that at all in my 20s and my 30s. But when I came back from when I pulled back from my corporate career, if you will, and went to run my own organisation, if I hadn't have done that, it'd have been a waste of time. I might as well have been paid the big bucks and carrying on trying to smash through big organisations and getting highly paid. So I had to pull back and say no and do things differently, or else my career change would have been a waste of time, to be honest. And my family were good. My dad, particularly, bless him, he was my good angel on my shoulder, saying, "What about?" And from the northeast, he say, "What about the burn? What about the burn?" And that all sounds great, and all you've done is talk to me about work. What about your daughter? And he was like I don't know what to call it really, but he was the custodian of my guilt, if you like, really. But no, I set boundaries and I stuck by them. And then I really enjoyed spending more time being with my daughter. I really leaned into it and I enjoyed it. So then I was motivated to not work as hard, because that was kind of more fun and I hadn't done loads of it. So I was like, oh no, I can't do that because I'm doing this with my daughter and I can't. So I found it, the longer I did it and I stuck to it, the easier it became. But it is hard for mums. It is hard, you know, especially when I remember when I went off on maternity, I'd get the odd email from HR saying, "Oh, we really wish you would come back a bit sooner because we've got a big deal on that you should be running with." You know, naughty stuff like that. You know, the things happen that shouldn't happen, really. Us girls, we've just got to fudge our way through it. And it doesn't get easier. You say to yourself, you like this, John, you say to yourself, well, when she's in senior school, it'll be easier. Not a chance. And then it's all the clubs. Then it's, I want to go to a party and I haven't been invited. I'm not in the popular crowd. You get a whole load of other things that you've got to deal with when they get older. So,
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt, it's a challenge. I mean, I have a daughter. She's grown up now. But, you know, listening to what you're saying there, John, I think there's a lot in there that people who are listening to this show can take from that, because they've seen you being successful on the other side of it.
Yeah.
That should be motivational. I hope it is anyway.
And then I think, you know, as women, we need to do our homework. We know that organisations with, one of the quotes, with at least 30% women on the board or in leadership positions are 12 times more effective. Yes. I mean, it really is important. And the young guy that I work for, I'll give him a shout out, Matthew Hurst at Utility Group, he wanted me on the board, and he wanted me as a woman on the board. And it, quite often he used to say, not only was I bringing my skills and my energy and my talents in role, but he said, I used to sometimes take the heat out of a situation. You know, I could just be like, if I was around, sometimes his team performed better because they weren't regressing into some of the old habits that they'd had as a team. Yeah. So not just, as I say, not just me in the role, but me as a woman on that board. And I also, I don't know, with being a mother as well, I used to coach him around procrastination. I used to say to him, you know what, when we had a big decision to make, I'm like, well, why do we need to make that decision today? Why do we really need to make that decision today? Why do we leave it, the drop-dead date for making a decision with a client, say, about responding to something they might have asked for us? The drop-down date is really Friday. Let's leave it and see who blinks first. Let's just leave it and see if they come up with a compromise and they present us with a compromise. And then that compromise might be a better outcome than we were going to go back just trying to fix the situation quickly. So I don't know whether that's a feminine trait of juggling too many balls at the same time and just saying, you know what, I don't have to deal with that stuff at school today. I need to do it on Friday.
Pressing the pause button.
Advice. And I'm John's smiling because I'm the least patient person in the world. Like, that is one thing I absolutely need to learn. I am absolutely, but what I am getting better at, and I've got a few decisions at the minute I need to make, and I'm actually doing that. I'm going, do you know what? I'm not going to make a decision. I'm going to see if somebody else will. But I do think that comes from motherhood. I wrote a blog about this, about, I think when you understand that trade-off and the boundaries, and maybe women need to recondition this in their own mind, is that putting boundaries in is not saying no, or I can't do that, or you're going to give less. It's about saying, actually, when I'm on, you're going to get a better energy level of me. And I think it's about really knowing that yourself and saying, well, no, I'm putting this hard boundary in because when I'm working for you, I know 100% why I'm doing it and who I'm doing it for, which is for my kids. But when I'm with my kid, I'm going to be 100% with them. And that's a difficult level to balance. But I think if you can get there, that's about working smarter, not harder. And if you've got an ability to prioritize, it doesn't matter how many hours you're doing it for.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you, I would like, it goes a little bit back to maybe that point on qualification. If I was asked to do something that I was either beyond my skill set, or I just didn't have the capacity, the bandwidth to do it and do the other things that were important in my life, I would happily say no, because they'd get a better performance out of somebody else. And because I'd built my career, I had my successes, I had enough scores on the doors and my CV to, you know, I could have walked away at any point really after I got to, say, mid-40s. I didn't have to say yes. I felt, you know, I wasn't compelled anymore to, you know, like sharp elbow my way in to the front and say, me do it, I'll do it. I'd just be like, well, I could do it, but I'm not going to be able to give it the energy and the commitment that it needs. So let somebody else do it. You know, I'll help you find somebody else to do it. Or do you want me to mentor the person that you select to do it? I can help that way, but I can't do it myself directly. No.
Yeah. Saying no is almost like giving somebody else an opportunity to say yes.
Yeah,
do you think it's seeing it like that? So it sounds like, you know, this absolutely amazing, incredible career in this very male-driven world, but very, you know, this is as far from charity work and helping other more vulnerable people and working in teams of women and with volunteers. This is as far from smart works as one could get, I think, your career. So how do you go from having your own business, this incredible career, to then being chair of Smartworks and making that leap from this massive private sector into the charity sector?
It is a big transition in every respect, really. But I'd been part of the management team that sold our business in Easter 2017. And I thought, yeah, retirement's going to be great. I'm going to have loads of things that I can do. My daughter was getting ready to go to university, so I didn't have any of that kind of family pressure on. Remarried successfully. But I had no one to, honestly, the God's honest answer is I had no one to play out with. All my peers are grafters. They all work for a living.
You still, you know, it was a early retirement.
Yeah, well, and isn't it a horrible word? And a friend of mine, Jane, and I are trying to think of a better word, because it is a horrible word, retirement, when you're young and you've got loads of energy and you can give back. I had always volunteered for various things in the kind of previous 10 years. I'd done the odd bit of volunteering for organisations locally in Manchester. And I knew I wanted to do something in Manchester itself. And then a friend of mine who knows me very well, she saw the job advert for the chair of Smartworks. And she said, Jan, I'm going to send this job advert to you. She said, it's got your name written all over it. It's about empowering women and fashion and clothes. It's you. It's got you to a T. And I'm like, oh, I'm not sure, Jill. I've done some investment. So I'd got, and I was on a board as a non-exec in a couple of places. Said, I've done a little bit, but it wasn't enough. And she knew it wasn't enough. She knew me well enough to know that it wasn't enough. And I had lost my sense of purpose. You know, there are all these TED Talks you can do about finding your purpose. And I'd always had a purpose. And I was without one. My daughter had gone. She didn't need mothering. In fact, she told me to completely back off when she went to university. Find your own friends. Find your own crowd.
Ouch.
And I had lost a purpose. So here was this jewel of a charity. It's Greater Manchester centric, although we now support women right across the Northwest region, Merseyside, Lancashire, Cumbria, Cheshire, obviously. And it is about that. It's a one-off intervention that makes a massive difference to a woman's chance of getting a job or not. So we see these unemployed, vulnerable, disadvantaged women. Some of them have been unemployed for 5-10 years. Others have been freshly unemployed. We had 70 odd women from Thomas Cook come to us last year after Thomas Cook went into receivership. So they come to us in one way or another, lacking in confidence, everything from broken to, I just don't know what I'm doing wrong. I'm applying everywhere, getting nowhere. And we put them through their appointment in Smartworks, where the first bit is dressing the part. I know now a lot of interviews are on Zoom, but you know, for me, it's not about the clothes. It's about the clothes that bring the confidence to the woman, that gets that woman standing an inch taller, feeling like, wow, actually, I look the part, so I might even be able to get the job. I look like I belong. So the clothes are a vehicle to build confidence. That's it. And we have fantastic relationships with retailers and with private donors. The quality of our clothing is fantastic. And our stylists are wonderful, empathetic, stylish women who know how they look at a woman, and I know exactly what they're going to do. And the lady will invariably come in and say, oh, I just want black trousers and a white shirt. And, you know, flat, flat, flat. And they'll go out in red stripes and navy blue and a pink dotted blouse or a yellow trench coat. They use the clothes to transform the confidence. And after that, they're already on a high, really. They then go into the one-to-one interview coaching.
Yeah.
Where they are more confident and they're more open to the concept that this time they might actually get that job. And the interview coaching is all about, let's nail this job. Let's absolutely nail this job. These are the questions you're going to get asked. These are the competencies that they're looking for. So let's translate what you've done in your past into a set of competencies where you will score highly on their interview process. And last year we had 420 women come to Smartworks and 88% of them went on to get the job.
It's just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And people might say, well, you know, clothes can make that difference, but it's not just clothes, is it? It's the confidence. I think what I hear from you is you've gone from selling SaaS products to going and helping women sell themselves and their confidence and their abilities. And it's just giving them, probably nobody's ever told them they're worth it before.
We do find that you can tell when a woman comes in who hasn't had a mom, a sister, an auntie saying, you know what, you look amazing. You can just tell, and they're down on the luck, but they need work. You know, they need to find a job, and there's not just the financial side of things, but the mental health and physical health and feelings of self-worth. And I don't do the styling and I don't do the coaching. We have a fantastic team of volunteers who were there before me and they'll be there after me, who are just the most dedicated bunch of women. I can't tell you how, but they always say, their Smart Works Day is the best day of their week. We have a wonderful volunteer called Pam, who is has a floristry business in Cheshire, and she does a Monday, and she's off sick at the moment. And she messages me saying, "Don't you dare give my Monday slot to anybody. It's the favourite day of my week."
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, when you're coaching people, how much you get out of it yourself, you know, and that's wonderful. Who came up with that idea then? How did you come to the idea of you know, really dressing to impress and building that confidence? Because that's the first step, isn't it? You know, you dress good, you feel good, your confidence goes up, and like you were saying, they've got an idea that this might work. So yes. Who came up with that?
Well, our chair, Jules, set the charity up in London around, I think it's maybe nearly eight years ago. She was already working in a similar type of organisation, but they wanted to stay very London-centric. And Jules was very much, "Lord, there are disadvantaged women in areas of high unemployment right across the UK. I don't want this to be a London, very fashiony thing. I want it to be a nationwide organisation." And Manchester was the second Smart Works to set up. So we've been going for 5.5. It was our fifth birthday in June. So long before I was involved. There are 8 centres around the UK. And if lockdown pandemic hadn't happened, there would have been a 9th opening this year, but we'll probably open a 9th next year. And we all follow a pretty consistent service delivery model. The clothing, that is so important to do first, because it's that first building of the confidence. It's that first time that woman might say, "All right, I don't know what I'm going to say when they say, tell us a bit about yourself, but I do know that I belong." And we try and give them that, an outfit that helps them blend in, which they want to, but also stand out. So there's always a pop of something in a Smart Works outfit. It might be a red shoe, might be a bright yellow scarf, but there's always something that gives them, when they put that final bit on, they know, actually, yeah, I look exactly as I did when Anushka or Pam or Jill dressed me in the Smart Works dressing room. And then the coaches do their magic. They're wonderful people. They've been in HR, or they've been recruiters or business people, and they'll just work out. We're using a Smart Works interview booklet. We give them an interview booklet, so they've got all the prep there. They'll work out how to translate. I haven't done anything. All I've done is look after my dad and my brother. They've been really sick, and da da da. Into a set of core competencies, like, so you've got organization skills. Yeah. So you're used to building a network, and you're used to challenging organizations that don't deliver what they're meant to for you in a time scale. So, you know, you just take what they've done and translate it into high scoring competencies that will get them the job. And then the other thing that happens, and this is a beautiful day when this happens, when the woman, we encourage the woman to contact us to say she's got the job, because when she does get the job, she comes back in and she gets another 5 to 7 items of clothing to make up a working wardrobe, so that she can get through to her first paycheck.
Amazing.
Feeling that way for 4 weeks. You know, sometimes there's a late delay, isn't there, between when they get paid or not.
Yeah, so that almost alleviates that imposter, well, helps to alleviate that imposter syndrome when you first get in to the job. And again, a lot of attrition happens in those first couple of weeks when people don't feel confident enough.
Yeah, I know. And at this time of year as well, well, not this year because of COVID, but last year and then the year before, for example, this time of year, we know that the woman will have a Christmas party to go to potentially, and she might not have anything to wear. So at this time of the year, we will accept donations of party clothes and bags and shoes. And then if they mention on their interview, you know, when they come for the second dressing, that they've got the job, we'll say, "Have you got a Christmas party?" And they'll say yes. And then the stylist will, if they've got something, the stylist will give them a party outfit as well. So they feel fantastic again in that environment. But you're absolutely right. The last thing we want in that first month until that woman's established herself in her job, we don't want that confidence to dip at all. We know that we're not doing another intervention with them. So what can we do to keep them confident? Well, we can give them a whole load of more Smart Works clothes, so that every time they pull that jacket out of the wardrobe, they remember how good they felt when they were with us, and it just helps them through until they're established themselves, I think, Rachel.
Yeah. So in terms of your leadership style, and you're in a very different situation now where you're leading volunteers, I can imagine for those volunteers that 88% ROI in business world, or you've got an 88% success rate, is incredibly motivating. But as a leader, what are the things that you employ, and what are the challenges that you face leading in a very different environment? It's far more complex in a lot of ways, in that people are giving their time. Talk us through those leadership challenges.
I've been a volunteer in other charities where it was difficult to motivate volunteers and to get them to actually do what they've said they're going to do. But in SmartWorks, honestly, there's very little leadership needed in the regard of managing those volunteers, because when we sign a volunteer up, we do it quite carefully, and we need to make sure that that volunteer can give us a regular day, or every other Tuesday, or every Monday. And we treat those slots, if you like, as really, those days is really precious to us as an organization, so that we don't take on a volunteer who thinks, so I might enjoy that, I can do 2 weeks on Wednesday and then next month I can do half a day. That doesn't work for our charity at all. It's too much for us to manage, and we've only got 3 members of staff and only 1 full-time. So we need for the volunteer, when we onboard her, to really be committed to what she's doing. And the volunteers that I have now are the volunteers pretty much who were in the organisation before I arrived. We've had to adapt it a little bit because we need people with online and virtual service delivery skills. So we've got a particular focus on young women at the moment. So we've taken on some younger volunteers, and others are the coaches who are comfortable doing coaching through Zoom and vehicles like that. But the volunteers, honestly, I don't have to lead them very much. I don't have to motivate them. They get motivated by the woman in front of them, who they know is going to step out of the centre and go and get the job next week. That's what gives them that drive and that pleasure to keep coming back week after week. And I think social media has made it easier, because we now promote our client good news stories. When the client's got the job, we'll have a picture of her in the outfit. And that's that kind of reinforcing circle, if you like, of goodwill that we have. So the main thing I've got to do really in the charity is I've got to work with the board on making sure the money comes through the door. That's the if I do nothing else and we don't bring the money in, that's my failure. So myself and the treasurer, we have a trustee who's responsible for social events, and we used to make our money up differently before COVID, before lockdown. We'd have events that were wonderful and sparkly, fashion and fairs, and who doesn't want to go, is it, to an evening like that and look at some great clothes and make donations to a wonderful charity. We always have wonderful support at those types of events. But very much this year, we've had to rely on grants. And you never know whether you're going to get a grant or not. And there's lots of third sector organisations who've needed support from organisations like the Prince's Trust and Sector 3 this year, you know, food banks and NHS charities and women's refuges. So we decided in March that we'd raised quite a lot of money from our annual Cycle for SmartWorks competition. I will plug that later, if you don't mind me. We'd raised a lot of money from an annual sporting event that we have on in the week running up to International Women's Day. So we had quite a bit of reserves. So what we decided as a board nationally with Jules's guidance was we would not, in the first 4 months, 5 months of the pandemic, go for grants that hand on heart, should have gone to more needy causes. So people who, you know, in homelessness charities, refuges, food banks, we could close our doors and reduce our costs a bit, which we did, but they couldn't. They had more customers than ever coming to them in real need. So now we're busily, we've got our Christmas campaign coming up that we've just launched yesterday, and then and that will be great for us. But really, it's my job is to make sure that we tap into every financial resource that's available to us across Greater Manchester. And we get a lot of help from people who know where grants are. The Small Charities Commissions helps us out quite a bit in terms of signposting where pockets of money have come to, and you know, all the work that the GMCA is doing and the LEP across the community is fantastic. That, you know, there's lots of ways of finding out what's out there.
Yeah, I think people just underestimate. They might look at a charity like Smartworks and think the Duchess of Sussex is a patron. You've only got a small number of employees. It's volunteer led. It doesn't need. It can often look like it doesn't need as much money as it does, but actually the running of it is what really requires the money, isn't it? And why it is important for people to donate if they can afford a little bit. I think we'll put a link on under the show notes. If you can just donate £5, it really would make a difference. So just
and what's lovely is if on the Virgin Money page, the link will be attached, we actually invite donors to write a message to a woman. So whether it's £5, £10, £25, if you write a little message of support, you know, in the Give the Gift of Confidence is Christmas, if you write a message of support to a woman, that message of support will go into the clothing pack that we give her. So you'll be directly not just giving money to help us keep going, but you'll actually be giving that final little message of confidence to a woman. And we like to think we're a community, not a charity, and that's the type of thing that makes a big difference to someone. Look, I've gone for a job and this random woman who I don't know donated £5, and she's written me this little message of confidence building. It's just magic, isn't it?
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Do you get at all involved in actually helping people find a job, or is that the bit that they come with?
That's a great question, because we didn't up to the pandemic. If you had to be a woman or identify as a woman, important point to make, unemployed with an interview lined up. But what we realised was that there weren't going to be as many interviews around, but there were a lot of people who were worried about losing the job or who had lost the job, who hadn't been furloughed. So we introduced the thing called career coaching, which is an hour's one-to-one coaching with one of our coaches, where even if you're unemployed and you've just started to think about, I need to build a CV, I don't know what type of work I should be going for, I don't know how to articulate my skills, what's a covering letter? We'll now do an hour's career coaching for anybody, any woman who's unemployed, who is thinking about starting that journey into work. Just have to contact the centre and we'll book them in with one of our amazing coaches.
I think, unfortunately, there's going to be a lot more need for that in the next year coming up. They're just the times we live in, and hopefully organisations like this can actually start to be part of the solution for getting more people back.
Yeah, we asked the job centres, with whom we have a fantastic relationship, the job centres in Ingeus, who run one of the employment and skills programmes across some of the boroughs, we said, what more can we do? What else could we be doing? Because we've got all these fantastic coaches who are motivated to volunteer. They could do 7 coaching calls a day, and they'd be happy to do so 5 days a week. And they said, well, can you do this upstream coaching where the person is just coming off some kind of employment support program, still on universal credit, but they've been working their way towards building their confidence to apply for a job? Could you do that last little bit? Because of course all the job centres closed physically, and most of them still are physically closed. So those extra bits of time and attention that the job centre coaches would love to give their clients but can't because they don't have the time, and a lot of them are now processing universal credit. You know, there's not that much support available. We hope that someone somewhere will shine a light on Smartworks for a client and they'll find the way to us. I've just put something on my local Facebook community page to say, look, we've got appointments available, please call us.
Do you get any feedback from employers as well then, Jan? That once somebody's got themselves a role, do you get feedback from the employers? Because of course they're getting somebody who's infinitely more confident than they would have been if you hadn't have helped them get ready for the job interview in itself.
Yeah, sometimes we do, and there are some local employers around Stockport and South Manchester who, for example, we take a lot of women, we support a lot of women who are coming out of Her Majesty's prison in style.
Right.
And they do, it's brilliant in style. They do NVQs in the restaurants, in the cafe there, you know, the Clink, the fantastic restaurant cafe that they have there. And those women have had a lot of support already from Her Majesty's Prison Service about re-entering work, you know, rehabilitation to enter into the workplace. And we'll take them as the final piece of the jigsaw, really, the final intervention, because what they don't have is the clothing.
Yeah.
And that extra little bit of somebody outside of the prison service building the confidence, the last bit. So we know all the employers in South Manchester who are prepared to take somebody from Her Majesty's prison in style. You know, they have to disclose it. It's already been disclosed on their application form. But, you know, there are people around who will actively say, I've got 10 vacancies for a restaurant and I'm happy to take women from the Clink for interview. And those people are wonderful, aren't they, to be open-minded enough to
like Timson.
Proactively say that.
Yeah, it's like Timpsons when they take about 10%, and it's wonderful. And they do free dry cleaning, and they'll repair your shoes for free if you have got a job interview and you're on Universal Credit. It's wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I'd like employers to say, if you apply to us and you've been through the SmartWorks process, we'll guarantee you an interview. I mean, that would be great for us, because you're helping the woman's chances infinitely, because they're going to be guaranteed the interview. But you're also, at the same time, because you've gone through the SmartWorks experience, you're probably more likely to get the job. But that takes a lot of work and a lot of and now's the tricky time to do it in lockdown, because employers, some organisations are massively growing in this period of time, but a lot of others are very nervous about, you know, what happens when everybody comes off furlough and they've got to pay the 100% of the wage bill again. You know, it's hard times for employers to think outside the box a little bit.
But we do have some HR managers listen to this, so that might spark an idea.
Oh, yes.
That might spark an idea with somebody. So why don't you just do a plug for your Confidence at Christmas campaign before we wrap up?
Oh, thank you. Well, we just would like women and men across the country to join our community. And a great way of doing it is by looking at some of the images that we've put out there, which are women who've been styled by our stylists who are beaming with confidence, because that's the gift that you're given if you decide to click on the Virgin Money link and donate £5, £10, or £25 to SmartWorks. It allows us to keep the service up and running. It costs £2,000 a week at full capacity to run SmartWorks. Mainly, as you've said, we've got 3 members of staff, but we've got 2,000 square feet because we need all the clothes and stock room and so on. So we do need a bigger physical space than an awful lot of charities. So if anybody has any unspent Christmas party money, any commute money that they haven't been spending because they've been working from home, or isn't buying a Christmas outfit because they're not going to a works party, anything would be appreciated. And please do remember to write a message of confidence for the woman, and we will give it to her as she goes into her interview.
Wonderful. And then just for anybody that's perhaps listening to this, that's feeling a little bit down on the luck at the minute, and perhaps has been made redundant and is listening to this for a bit of inspiration, is there any message of that you could give that might help just build somebody's confidence that perhaps doesn't fall into the SmartWorks group, but is struggling all the same with the confidence? What would be words of advice?
Well, I think don't forget that people care. People that you don't even know care. Nobody likes to see somebody down on the luck and feeling fed up and borderline depressed about what's happened to them. Nobody likes that. And generally I find, certainly in this community that we've got across Greater Manchester, people really care as a community and ask for help. You know, if you need help, there's lots of resources available. Approach your local council. There are groups, for example, across Cheshire and Stockport, there's a group called Wave of Change, which is run by a charity called the Goodness Collective. Excuse me. And that's about helping women gain the confidence, build the skills as well that they need to do the next thing that they might want to do. That might not be going to employment. It might just be find happiness for a day a week, or get themselves out of a situation of loneliness, and just by talking to other people. And they've got a tremendous network of an organisation. And there's all sorts of things going on out there that will help mitigate some of those feelings of lacking in confidence. You know, networking groups that have now moved themselves online, Didsbury Good Neighbours is one that's close to me, and that they've moved as everything that they can online just to give people access to a friendly face, a listening ear, and you know, a hand up in these difficult times. It doesn't have to be a hand out, a hand up and a hand held is sometimes more important, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll add one to that that I think you will really love. I think this year has been the year of the tracksuit and the leggings, and you forget to make an effort, don't you? I think when you're at home all the time in lockdown, and I think never underestimate that the simple way to boost your confidence is to dress up for a day.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've not donned a tracksuit. I'll get up and I'll work out and I'll walk my dog. I've been very lucky. I've got a dog, so I'll walk the dog. And even just that brings fresh air, energy, smile on your face normally. Who doesn't love that? If you don't, I'll do a plug now for one of the companies I'm invested in. If you don't have a dog, borrow a dog. There's a platform called borrowmydoggy.com, which is insanely beautiful as a concept. And you can meet and borrow other people's dogs to take them for walks, and through that develop quite often friendships with the owners and other things. So that's a lovely thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And that leads us really nicely. The way we end every one of our podcasts is we get our guests to share their three leadership essentials. So three leadership tips that you'd like to share.
Yes, well, I think I'd said, other than at the very beginning of my career, I've typically been in like a transformational leadership role. So we're at A and we're trying to get to B. We're not at A and we just want to keep A going as best we possibly can. I haven't done a lot of that. It's normally been A to B as fast and as successfully as we possibly can. So according to the idea of transformational leadership, for me, an effective leader is a person who creates an inspiring vision of the future, can motivate and inspire people to engage with that vision, and lastly, and critically, can manage the delivery of that vision. It's that last bit you have to remember. You still have to manage it all, don't you? I've got a great thing that I talk about sometimes. There's 10 roles that a leader must do, and some of it is really pragmatic. Some of it is people do need to turn up, and they do need to put the shift in. Do you know what I mean? It's not all about visioning in strategy. Sometimes it is about efficiency and effectiveness. So you can't forget that management bit.
Well, that has just been absolutely incredible. I could listen to you all day, to be fair. I'm really feeling for your voice. You've been chatting away. Is there anything else you want to ask, John?
No, I'd just like to really echo your sentiments really there, Rachel. You know, running a wonderful cause at the moment to give and help people gain confidence has got to be one of the best things a human being can do for another human being, because we're all down on it every now and again, some more than most. But if you haven't got it at all, it's a crushing place to be. And I think it's, really laudable. So I wish you all the best raising some more money, and hopefully some of our listeners would like to donate.
Yeah, great. I just hope your listeners enjoy it, have learned something, and thank you for putting up with me for this time.
Wonderful. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, Google Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcasts from, and give us a rating so other people can find this content. You can also find us on Twitter or Instagram at Scaffold Coach.